This is the Saturday Night Live Friday Speaker Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California on August 18, 2000. Our speaker is Diane F. of San Francisco, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL Tape Library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Diane. I'm an alcoholic. Don't drive from San Francisco to San Jose on a Friday night. We left like before 6, and we just got here. I didn't know. I guess I haven't been commuting in and out of the city, so I didn't realize it was like, it's crazy. And maybe you know that. Maybe you do some commuting, and you're all going, yes, okay, I'm the last one to know. Anyways, it's really good to be here, and it's good to see some, recognize some faces, not a lot, but recognize some faces. I got sober here a little over 15 years ago, and actually was over at Room 47, the magical place y'all, some of you have heard about. And I hope wherever you get sober, when you look back, it seems magical to you. So what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, for how long? How long do I share?
Hour and a half.
I can do it, you know. Those of you who know me. Quarter after. Okay. I just got to make sure, because I always go over. No, just kidding. So I grew up in this area here, and grew up over in Santa Clara, and my sister's here with me tonight. We're 15 months apart. We've always been like this, and very close, and I have a younger brother. And we grew up in an alcoholic home, and it was difficult. It was very hard. And being the middle child, I was always trying to fit in with my sister, and I was always trying to fit in with my brother, and I never felt like I fit in. And I never liked myself from very early on in life. I hated myself. I remember looking in the mirror and saying, I hate you. And I don't know why. That was just the early things that I remembered about myself when I first got sober. Of course, the longer I've stayed sober, the more has come back to me. A lot of good memories have come back to me, thank goodness, not just the things that were unpleasant. And I've got to say, coming to Alcoholics Anonymous was never my idea. I mean, I didn't even really know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought it was a place where old men went. I mean, old men with raincoats, you know, and guys that put booze in brown bags. That's what I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was when I first started hearing about it a little bit. I probably would have never thought it was something for me. First of all, I never knew I had a problem drinking. I never identified the things that happened to me and the situations I got myself into as a result, some way or another, from alcohol. I had no idea. And it's been really interesting having that revealed to myself very slowly. You know, everything wasn't really clear when I first got here. I was in quite a fog. I did not go through any recovery program. I basically got sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and Cocaine Anonymous and my therapist's office. and I did seek therapy. I was going to therapy to support my brother, the family counselor, because he's the one who got in recovery first. And I had no idea that I was going to be following in his shoes. And I'm so grateful that God intervened in our life. Because it wasn't my brother's idea either to get sober. He got caught. And so it's like one of those choices. Maybe some of the court card people can relate to that. You know, it's a choice. Well, do I do this or do that? And he decided to go to recovery. And that's kind of what broke our family system, is he got sober. I'm going to be distracted because I have a new baby. It's my first one. Just looking to see how he's doing. Anyways, what I wanted to focus on tonight was how the steps have worked in my life, and I'm going to use the format, what it was like and what happened, what it's like for me now. But I got to tell you, just coming to Alcoholics Anonymous and attending meetings wasn't enough for me. And I did that for a while. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with my head down. I knew what the floor looked like from my house to my favorite home group. But it was really hard for me to look into people's eyes. It was very hard for me to feel like I was worthy enough to be here. And I heard that if you picked up ashtrays, you know, or helped clean up, that helped me stay around the rooms after the meeting was over. It was really hard to meet people. I was very shy, painfully shy. But if I was cleaning and washing out coffee cups or picking up ashtrays and stuff, like we used to smoke in these rooms, then it was okay for me to stay. And then I'd kind of like listen to hear, you know, you guys were going out to coffee. No way. That was way too scary for me to go out to coffee. I didn't go out to coffee, I don't think, until I was about 9 months sober. Way too much for me. But I heard you guys doing things, you know, and you knew each other. Also, the group where I got sober, Saturday Night Live, it seemed very incestuous to me. It seemed like everybody was hugging everybody and kissing everybody. I'm like, what's going on with these people? I thought everyone was sleeping with each other, and that's all I'm going to say on that one. And I just thought everybody was a little too friendly with each other. And I felt like a real outcast, and I wanted that attention, and I wanted that affection. Not that much affection, but I wanted the hugs, you know. And I was starving to be loved unconditionally. I didn't know it, but I was starving to be loved unconditionally. And so I really, when I came here and I sat down and I listened, in the beginning I sat in the back of the room because I was afraid and I was nervous and I didn't know anybody, and I came to most of these meetings by myself. My mom came to quite a few meetings with me. She got sentenced to me because when I hit my bottom I was suicidal. And they were talking about me over here, and I was kind of like sitting there, and they're like, well, should we check her into a place or not, you know? And I said, look, I'm fine. Just don't leave me by myself, because I in order to feel anything, I needed to feel pain. And I want, and the only way I could get that was to self-induce it. And I needed to feel a lot of pain to feel that I was alive. So if you can relate to that, you know where I was headed. I was really shut down. Shut down otherwise. I didn't trust men. I had been crossed by a lot of guys, lots of lies. I didn't trust women, crossed by a lot of women, lots of lies. And I didn't believe my parents anymore. And those were people that were real staples in my life. But I thought, yeah, they just tell me what I want to hear. I didn't think that they were objective, you know, and could help me anymore. So that didn't really leave anybody. And when I sat in the back, that what I heard was that I heard all your, what it was like. I heard all the horror stories. I heard all the bad things that happened to you. And I sat back and I'm like, yeah, yeah, I'm a bad person too. And yeah, I put myself in those situations. That's all I could relate to, is what happened, all the bad stuff. And I didn't hear any of the good stuff right away. That wasn't the first thing that I heard. The hope, you know, the change, the lovely miracles that happened here. I didn't hear any of that right off. I did go to meetings. Oh, man, I went to, for my first 3 years, I went to like 3 or 4 meetings a day. It was the only place I felt safe. I had to move back home from school into my parents' home to get sober. My brother was in a recovery home, so I was the only one home, and I had to break the mold at home of the dysfunctional that comes from alcoholism. And it was really hard. I only had 2 friends when I moved back up here, so basically, it's kind of like no friends. One of them drank, and another one just got married, and I think she had a little girl, so, you know, I couldn't relate to that. And I was trying to get sober, and trying to get sober is so different than trying to get loaded. When you're trying to get sober, you've got all this free time. You're not recovering from a hangover. You know, it's like I don't need to make any plans for the weekend because I'm not going to party. And I had all this, like, extra time that I didn't know what to do with, and I had lots of time on my hands, and that was dangerous for me. And part of it was dangerous because I started feeling, you know, when there's not a lot of stuff to fill in that time, the feeling started coming up. Oh, man, that is very scary. And what I did is I filled it by going to lots of meetings. I got a job, the same place that I worked before I went to college. I went back and worked there after I graduated with a degree, and had the same job in a retail store. And I was close enough where I could go to a meeting at lunch, I could go to the 6 o'clock meeting, an 8 o'clock meeting, and if I needed to, the 10 o'clock meeting, you know, or the midnight. We had midnight. We probably still do. Okay. And I just did whatever it took, wherever I felt safe. And I can't say that, you know, I got a lot of phone numbers. I can't say that I called people right off the bat because that was way too hard. You didn't really mean what you said. Call me anytime. You know, you're just saying that. And I thought my problems were my own to figure out. I always felt that way, that my problems were my own. And I always thought that I was raised with a God in my life and a religion. You know, if you hold them up, if you hold them up here, I mean, turn around and face him to you, he might stop crying. He got his shots 2 days ago, so he's kind of fussy, and I guess I am too. So growing up, trying to fit in with my brother, trying to fit in with my sister, and going off to school. I loved school because I met a lot of new kids. I love meeting kids. I love meeting people. I've always loved that part of it. And I liked school. I joined every kind of activity under the sun so I didn't have to go home. I didn't realize that. And I was really good in sports, so I played a lot of sports. And when I was about 15 years old, I got diagnosed with scoliosis. My sister actually noticed that one hip was higher than the other, and so they put me in a brace. So I had a brace like from here down to, you know, down to here, and it covered all the way around with metal bars, blah, blah, blah. You can't disguise it, okay? I tried. And I got yanked out of sports. And that was the only place where I felt really confident. And the world just kind of melted away. And I really got into just, you know, focusing on whatever it was I was playing. And needless to say, that changed my life. Up to this point, relationships in my life, I had girlfriends, you know, and I did have some girlfriends. This one girl, she was like the most popular girl, one of the most popular kids in between grammar and high school. We had like 7th and 8th grade. Junior high. And and I don't know why she did this. Like, we were really close friends, and we went to each other's houses and stuff, which is a big deal. That's a big step when you're that age. And I don't know why she did this, but one day we went to school, and in front of all the tough kids, you know, or all the popular kids, she just started yelling at me and going off on me and saying, "I hate you, I can't stand you, you're this, you're that, you're always thinking that you're funny," and all this stuff. And I was like, I was just shocked. I didn't stand up for myself. I didn't say, "You're full of shit." I would never say something like that. I didn't have those words and I didn't have those feelings. I just sat there and I was like, wow, she doesn't like me and this is really embarrassing, you know. And it was something I just kind of pushed down and I didn't really know how to cope with. And when I moved on to high school, I had some other girlfriends and some guy friends. I had lots of guy friends. And then once I got that brace on, it seemed like everything kind of changed. Everybody treated me differently, like there was something wrong with me. And pity, a lot of pity. And that really bothered me. I wanted people to like me. That's still hard for me to say. I wanted people to like me. And I just kind of did whatever you kind of suggested that I do. I kind of went with the flow. I hardly ever had an original idea in my head as far as what I wanted for myself. Oh, you should be a cheerleader. You think I should? Yeah, you should, because you know the guys and you know how to play the game. It wasn't about short skirts and cute uniforms and skits, because I didn't care for any of that. It was about, you know, supporting my guy friends. I'm like, okay. So I was a cheerleader for a while, and I loved that. That was fun. And then they told me, you know, well, you should be class president. Oh, you think so? I mean, I had no confidence, no self-esteem. And then once I got these things, I didn't know what to do with them. You know, I was like, okay, now I'm here. Where's everybody that was telling me what to do with it? I mean, I was totally lost, and I felt like a fraud. This is, you know, that feeling of having the outside but nothing on the inside was already starting for me. This continued on, and my relationships, I had a really good relationship with my parents, though. My mom and dad, through thick and thin, have always loved us and always told us that they loved us and showed us that they loved us, and I'm very fortunate. Our family's gone through a lot, and we've come out of it, and we're not all in recovery, but we've definitely all been impacted by Alcoholics Anonymous, definitely. People don't have to get sober to be impacted by it either, which is really neat. Thank goodness. Because it's not for everybody. And significantly for me, when I think about step one, being powerless over alcohol and that my life is unmanageable, I mean, I just kept doing my thing. I loved to drink. My first drink was about, I was about that same age, about 15, and I loved to drink. I went to some big party, and we went out in the backyard, and there was a keg of beer, and it was like, God, you know, here it is. You're going to have a drink, you know, and it was that time for me to have a drink, my first drink. So I had a drink, and I tasted it, didn't care for the flavor, but I saw everyone was doing it. So I knew if I'm going to go to these parties, I have to learn how to do this, because this is what you do at these parties. And after I drank a whole bunch, that night I drank a whole bunch of beer, I drank champagne, a lot of champagne. And I was, you know, I loved it. I was like, I just felt fluid, you know, and warm and attractive. And I could talk to the older guys. And I just felt all that self-consciousness just kind of melted away from me. And I just felt, I'm okay. I can do this. And, of course, it only lasts for a little while. and that is why I drank, because I kept trying to melt down all that insecurity and just push aside all that low confidence. And I always used to party before I went to the party. I always had to drink before I went out. I always drove drunk. I never got caught. But I always drove drunk. I always drove drinking. Other people in the car. You know, I was just lucky. And that's it. I could be somebody here with a DUI so easily. I drove in blackouts. I'd wake up the next day and I'd see my car half on the sidewalk and I'd go, whoa, I had a good time. You know, I didn't look for blood. I heard people say that afterwards, like, I looked for blood on the fender or see if I hit somebody. I never thought of that. I just thought, yeah, I had a great time. I never thought about how what I did and my choices impacted other people. Just thought about myself. So by the time I got here and I heard about step one, being powerless, my life was so unmanageable that I was suicidal. You know, I was only 24 and I was thinking, I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't be here. And no matter how many times I try to change my life, I try to change the things I do, I try to start over, I try to start fresh, start, you know, okay, Monday I'm going to do this. My birthday I'm going to do this. New Year's I'm going to do this. I could never stick with anything. You know, I just couldn't see it through more than a week or a day or whatever it was. And that could be my food. That could be my drinking. It could be a guy. You know, it could be anything. But I had no direction. I was like rudderless, you know, a boat just all over the place. You know, you push me, you want me to go that way, I'll go that way. I didn't care and I didn't know. And I didn't realize that drinking was such a big part of this. So being powerless over alcohol was really clear by the time I got here and that my life was unmanageable. The part about the alcohol was I told you my brother had gone into treatment, and I was going to a counselor, and she had me try controlled drinking. And controlled drinking is when you pick a number of drinks, and you go out, and that's the number of drinks you're going to drink. I know. I never did that, you know. I'm like, what, 2, 3, you know, and I never knew how much at that time it was going to take to get drunk or not drunk or never get drunk. You drink 15 drinks and never get drunk. Alcohol was very unpredictable at the end. And so she had me do that for 3 months. I don't think I ever even consciously tried it. I just went out and just kept drinking, and that's how I hit my bottom. And the night of my bottom was, I just had so many things happen to me when I was drinking. Being with men that I really didn't want to be with, being with one-night stands. How many times have I said, I've never done this before, you know, and the guy goes, I haven't either, you know, and we believe each other, right? And, I mean, not a whole bunch, but, you know, more than once. I had more than one-night stand. Lying to myself and hating myself when I get, you know, when you wake up and you're sober and you're like, oh, what did I do that for? Because I call it liquid courage. I could never do the things that I did drinking sober because I knew they were wrong, morally wrong for me. They hurt the moral fiber inside of me. But I didn't realize that I wanted to do them. I had this itch and I felt like I had to do it. Where I was going to school, it seemed like everybody was doing experimenting with sex and all that kind of stuff, you know, and I wanted to too. I after going through being in that brace, I went through an operation and I was in a body cast for a year, and I just kind of turned off sexually. I just kind of became asexual. I just lost touch with femininity and who I was around that area, and went through puberty when I was going through those 5 years of the brace and the and the cast. And so when I came out of it, I had these guys like, whoosh, they were looking at me. I'm like, what? You know, you weren't looking at me before. I'm still the same person, but I lost all the stuff, you know, on the outside, and I was attractive, and I didn't know. And when I figured that out, man, I was mad. You know, I was like, what? You like me because I look good now, but I'm the same person. And that really bothered me a lot. And then when I was in school, I roommated with a woman, and she was from England, and she fell in love with me. And that really made me mad because I was like, oh, man, maybe I'm gay. You know, I don't know. And I was mad because she brought the question to my forefront, you know. Not that, you know, for me, one way or another, it doesn't matter, but I didn't know, and it was like, oh, man. And she made all her friends, my friends, her friends. She really integrated herself into my life like a boyfriend. You know, and I was kind of thinking it was kind of weird because I had a boyfriend at that time, and she would get jealous when he would come and visit me and stuff. And I was like, what's up with her? And then I'm like, click, 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 you know, it starts, oh, okay, I get it, she's in love with me. And then I moved into a house with, I'm not going to live with one person again. I'm going to move in a house with a bunch of people. I'm going to come and go. I'm not going to know anybody. So I move into this house with two women and two men. And this one woman, like, she's trying to be my friend. She's trying to be my friend. And I'm, like, holding her off, because I don't want anything to do with her. And I got involved with this other guy who said something about being in Camarillo State for cocaine. You know, and I'm like, I didn't know anything about that. But I liked the guy, right? And so we started going out. And I knew there was something fishy going on, intuitively. And this girl finally got close to me, and I let her in. And then all of a sudden, my boyfriend and her are going to this wine class, right? Oh, they tell me this, and I believe them. They're going to this wine tasting class. And I hope you're laughing because it's behind you and you've been there, you know? And I was like, okay. And then I started thinking, well, maybe they're doing something. And so I went up to them and I asked them, well, I feel really bad asking you this, but, you know, are you? And they look at me both and they go, no, and I believe them. And, you know, they're lying to me. And I didn't know it. I was like the last one to know. All my roommates knew. This guy ended up going back into jail, calls me up on Easter Sunday morning. I really want to see you. My bail's $200, you know. And I was in school. I didn't have it. That was my rent money. And I used my rent money to bail him out because I really like him, right? Probably thought I was in love with him. And so I go and I bail him out. And my roommate advanced me $200. I go, as soon as my rent comes in, you know, I'll give you that money. And he goes, are you sure you want to do this? I'm like, yeah, I'm positive. He goes, are you sure? He was trying not to betray, I think, the other roommate's confidence. But he knew, and he goes, I got to tell you, that guy's a worm. And I was like, okay, give me the money, you know. And this guy, after I bail him out, I find him in his closet. His roommate said, well, he was just in there. And I look in his closet. He's hiding from me, passed out in his laundry, behind the closet door. You know, like, this is the guy I want to be with, okay? So who has the problem, him or me? Water seeks its own level, okay? And I was comfortable with that. It took me a long time to get over that guy, okay? That wasn't the end for me. Emotionally, I got wrapped into people like this all the time. Maybe it sounds familiar to you. Same story, different face, different name, different town, same story. Do you have any money? Because I don't have any, you know? And I always had the money, and you know how it goes. So anyways, relationships for me, this is what started crumbling. Then I moved into a house. I had my high school sweetheart come up, and that gal that befriended me, I feel like I'm telling a, you know, mini-series here, but this is really true. That gal that befriended me, well, she knew I was in the bedroom with that cocaine guy, right? And my old sweetheart comes up. He moved all his stuff, closed down the house where he was living, put all his stuff in a U-Haul and came up to, like, sweep me off my feet, but he didn't tell me, so I didn't know he was coming. And she, like, lets him into the bedroom when she knows I'm with that other guy in bed. And I was just like, is this my life? You know, and the guy I was with wanted to crawl out the window. I said, you don't have to crawl out the window. I go, he's not going to, you know, like the guy was going to do something to him, you know. It was a mess. It was horrible. And this was my life, and the feeling part of it, Shoved it down, drank more. And that was how I coped with things. So I just kept shoving it down. I felt really bad about things. I knew I was a little scumball, you know, and I knew things weren't working out right, but I didn't know why. And the last straw was moving again, this is all during school, into another house where there was four girls in there. and my high school sweetheart and I got back together. And he was saying, well, why don't you get some NA beer, you know, non-alcoholic beer. And I go, yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah. Did we ever buy it? No, we never bought it. You know, I just kept steering away. I like beer. I thought light beer was like light alcohol beer, you know. So I had light beer. I switched to light beer. And this guy ended up, he wanted to marry me. You know, we were supposed to make a go of it. And he ended up leaving me. One night I was already loaded. And we lived right on the coast, I mean literally on the coast, and there was a cyclone fence because there was a cliff. And the cyclone fence is to keep you on the side that's safe. So what do? I'm loaded, I take my six-pack, and I walked around the cyclone fence, and I'm sitting on the cliff, hanging with my legs hanging over the cliff, thinking I'm going to finish this six-pack because I need time to think, and then I'm going to walk around. And the guy looks at me, and he just gives me this look. It's like a moment of clarity, like, what are you doing? And I could see we had that connection in our eyes, like, are you crazy? You know, he didn't say that, but what are you doing? And I was like, I didn't say anything. I just go, and you know, and I just kind of like, oh, I better not do this, you know, and I walked around with my little six-pack, I don't know, and I went somewhere else. So this guy ended up leaving, and thank goodness he did because he saved himself. I would have dragged him down with me easily. He went to save himself, so I'm there by myself. And I thought I graduated from college. I went through the ceremony, had the nice little brunch with Mom and Dad, came down and everything. Turns out later I didn't even graduate. I was short credits. And I had to move back home. And I was not looking forward to moving back home. I had stayed at in a job where I was, it was called Walk and Roll. It was a fast food oriental place. And I actually did the walk, and I used to go in the walk-in refrigerator. We had little jokes for everything, the walk-in refrigerator. And I used to down beers while no one was looking. I'd go in and I'd down a couple beers, and then we did deliveries too because it was a student town. I'll go out for a delivery, and I shoved beers in my socks, you know, and in my sleeves. And then I'd go out on the three-wheeling putt-putt that I crashed and wrecked. A three-wheeling putt-putt I crashed and wrecked. I don't know what happened to it, I told them. You know, I just said, I don't know what happened. I don't know. Can't be me. I mean, I look back on that and I just think, how dumb was I? I mean, and these people believe me, you know. So and, you know, students don't have any money, so the tips were like bong hits or beers, you know. I'm like, I'll go deliver, you know. And so I'm getting close to hitting my bottom after all of this. And I was going to focus on the steps, and I'm going into my stories. So my bottom was my dad came down to... I spent my brother's 21st birthday in October getting high with him all night. We were in Daddy's caddy, and we were doing cocaine all night. And I never said no. I mean, he just kept going more and more, and he's 3 years younger than me, and I just thought it was really fun. We had a great time. And we stayed up till 5 o'clock in the morning. And he goes, come on, let's do some more. I'm like, no, I really need to go to bed. And I didn't understand that addiction because I didn't really have the money. And so I just did if it was free or if it was given, but I never said no. But it wasn't something I chased. Alcohol was what I chased. And I didn't recognize in him that he had a problem. So in December, after I graduated, my dad came down and he said, you know, your brother has to go into treatment. He has a cocaine problem. Stole all my parents' money, you know, and I was like, wow, but how can he have a problem? I was just with him in October and I didn't notice, you know. And I had a choice of leaving my great job at Walk and Roll after almost getting my collegiate degree, right? And I got an offer to go to this new place called, it was the graduate, it's in Santa Barbara, is where I lived in Isla Vista, and they opened up this nightclub called The Graduate. Was the first one in Isla Vista. And I got a job there. And some little voice in my head said, if you stay, you die. Because The Graduate was dark. If I worked in The Graduate, I would never know if it was day or night. It would be all over. It would just be great. And at this time, at the end of my school, I was living by myself because, you know, it didn't work with people anymore, right? So I was living by myself, started hearing voices. I had the shades drawn for 3 days at a time. I wouldn't answer the phone. Not that anybody was calling me, but, you know, I wasn't answering the phone. And I knew they were scheming to get me. I could hear them. I could hear the little whispers. And they were coming to get me. And I could hear by my window the click, click, click of the 10 speed, you know, because they were right underneath my window listening to me and waiting and watching me, you know. So I was really paranoid. I'd start buying my beer in different liquor stores because they're counting and watching me, you know, and my drinking. And it was pretty sad. It was pretty pathetic. And especially for someone who's 24 years old living in a college town, there's all these great things happening, and they're not happening to me, I'll tell you that. So I decided to move back home to my mom and dad, just temporarily, mind you. Put all my stuff in boxes. I didn't even unpack. I was there for 3 years, but I was only going to be there for just a couple months until I got my stuff together. And I ended up getting sober at my parents' house. And then when I came home, I went out to drink with my girlfriend. And I had seen my old high school sweetheart, and I told him some of the secret things that happened to me that I was really ashamed of. I confided in him some of the horrible things that I thought happened to me. And that night I went out drinking, and I happened to end up in the same place he was with another gal. And in my sick mind, I thought he had replaced me. And I just went into this fit. I just got totally hysterical. My girlfriend had to slap me to get me out of it outside. I just remember going whack, and I'm like, you know, whoa. And I was crying. And then the next day I couldn't stop crying. And I couldn't stop crying. That whole night I cried. And what happened is I ended up having an emotional breakdown. And then I got really quiet and I closed in. And my mom was really worried. But what happened was I was already going to counseling for my brother. So I already had a counselor that I was seeing. And it just worked out perfectly. This is the woman that had me try drinking for 3 months, controlled drinking for 3 months. So I went to see her that Monday. And that's how I got sentenced to AA. And I drove up to San Francisco. My brother was living up in San Francisco. And, you know, I always wanted somebody to care about me and ask me, how was I doing? How did I feel? Give me that chat that I always gave to everybody else. But nobody really seemed interested in what was really going on with me. And my brother sat me down. I remember upstairs in the attic, sat me down, and he goes, I was like, blah, 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 about superficial stuff. And he goes, what's going on with you? What's wrong? And I said, oh, nothing, blah, blah, blah. And he looked me straight in the eye, and he goes, bullshit. He goes, what's going on with you? And then I just broke down. And it was really humbling for me to break down with my little brother, you know. And I remember he told me, say a prayer and go to a meeting. And I was already going to meetings for him. So I went to a meeting for myself that night. My first AA meeting was out in Fremont. And all I remember is the men. That's where I was at. I used to share when I was new that it was a men's meeting, but the woman was a secretary. But all I saw in the meeting was guys. And I thought, oh, this is a great place to go. You know, and they were wearing, like they had played softball or something. So I'm like, oh, cool, maybe I can get on the softball team. You know, I'm really into the AA part of it. And I went up to the woman at the end of the meeting, and I said, how can I join? And she gave me a meeting guide, and she wrote her number on the back. She said, just keep coming back and don't take a drink in between meetings. I'm like, and that was it. And then, like, you know, sends me off on my way. And I'm like, I didn't understand. That was too much for me. I didn't understand what that meant. And I thought there was going to be more here. I don't know what I thought. And so I kept going to meetings. And I kept going to meetings. And very, very slowly, slowly, slowly for me, I've learned what Alcoholics Anonymous is all about. And slowly I learned that the power for me is in the steps in my communication with God. And that's where all the change comes, and that's where all the good stuff comes from. But I didn't know that. I still had to go through a lot of rocky roads to get to that understanding. I'm still going through a lot of rocky roads to get to that understanding. And so it was really easy when I got to step two to believe that there was a God in my life, because AA wasn't my idea. And when I came to AA, I'm very fortunate. I haven't had to drink again. And it's been over 15 years. And that, you know, why did it happen to me and not somebody else? I don't know. I have no idea. I was just so afraid I was going to get struck drunk. I was like, okay, what are we supposed to do? Okay, do this, that. And I remember John Carney goes, you know, Diana, you're not going to get struck drunk. And I'm like, oh, I'm not? You know, like, it's not going to just happen to me when I'm not looking. I was just so afraid to do the wrong thing that I would drink. Except for I did a lot of the wrong things. One thing that I did do was I hung out with the guys when I got here instead of the women. And I hung out. I had a couple of really good friends and one really good guy friend that I just talked to every day, a couple times a day and stuff. And I was really scared of women. Guys were easier because I was used to them being my pals. And unfortunately, what ended up happening is I got date raped by this guy, and you know, and he was my best friend in here, and I was 9 months sober, and that was a really big pill to swallow of reality, very hard to swallow. And I came back. I didn't go out or anything, but I came back around, and I didn't leave AA, but I came back into AA after that happened, looking for women. You know, as hard as the women were to be around, that's what I needed to do. And I found out the hard way. And I was really afraid to go to a women's meeting. I didn't know what you guys did in these women's meetings, but I was totally afraid of them. I thought, oh, yeah, it's probably going to be like a Cosmopolitan magazine. Because I was a tomboy. I thought, it's just going to be like a Cosmopolitan. They're going to talk about guys and sex. And I didn't know how to talk that way, okay? So I was just scared. But I didn't know that. So my sponsor had me go to this house meeting, which was even worse than going to a room. It was somebody's home, more intimate. And I went there, and I was totally petrified. And in this meeting, they did talk about guys and sex. You know, it just so happens. But I found a friend there who's still my friend today, who was a tomboy, and her and I could relate to each other. So I made one little friend there, and it was worth it just going for that. And I stayed sober. It's the women in Alcoholics Anonymous that taught me how to dress, that taught me how to kind of just converse with men. I was so afraid of guys. My mom raised me. Boys only want one thing. And I didn't know what that one thing was because she never told me, but they only want one thing. You know, so when they got close and I felt this energy, I thought, this one thing's coming. You know, I don't know what it is, but get back. You know, I was totally afraid of guys until I drank. And then it was like, woohoo. But I didn't put the two together. So when I got into AA, you know what it's like when you get sober, you go back to where you started. You know, so I had to go back. And what I did was I worked on my family of origin first. When I got to step three, and there came time to make a decision in my life. I was clear-headed at this time, and I tried to make a conscious decision to try to do something different in my life. Now, I don't know how many times I've done that, but I was going to play your game to the end. You know, I heard people say, you know, it can work for you. It worked for me. You know, and these people have these horrific stories, you know, nothing like anything I experienced. It worked for me. It can work for you. And I thought, well, there must be a little loophole here where it's not going to work for me. And you'd read the, in the beginning, the preamble, you know, where like, some of us are not fully capable of being honest. I'm like, oh, that's probably me, you know. And they said, but they do have the capacity to get better, you know. And I'm like, oh, okay, there's no loophole there. You know, I was just thinking, if this didn't work, I was really, really in trouble because I was putting my stock in you guys. And I kept coming to meetings, and I watched people go through things in their life, very difficult, people dying, people losing family members, real things of life, not, you know, I don't have enough money to, you know, do this or that. That's, to me, that was my heartache, but the real heartaches were here with bigger things that were happening to you guys. And I saw you guys get through, and I saw you stay sober. And that's how I let Alcoholics Anonymous start creeping into my life. So step three for me, when I made that decision, I was really conscious about it. Okay, I'm trying to keep this GP too, so I keep thinking of all these old things I used to say, you know, that are like swear words, and I'm trying really hard not to say them. So it was pedal to the metal, you know, and go full bore with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I did. And I gave it everything I had. I jumped in, and Alcoholics Anonymous was my life. I was a little moony child of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I was involved in everything. I've done general service. I've done H&I for 3 years. I got on committees and was doing conferences. I really got into conferences. A great way to meet people and travel and keep it fresh. I was going all over the place. I loved it. It was my life. Scared to death to step my foot outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just wasn't ready for that. There's enough here for me. Keep me happy. Kept me happy for a long time. So step three, I dove right into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did what my sponsor suggested. Now, I had a couple of different sponsors. Actually, I've had a few sponsors. The first one, I walked up to her. I was totally afraid. I knew she was going to say no because I'm not good enough for someone to help me. And I picked this woman, and I go up there. I'm like, I need a sponsor. You know, I could barely get the words out. And she goes, oh, Nancy, come on over here. I've got someone for you. And she gave me her sponsee. And she put us together. And that's not what I wanted. I wanted her. And I was like, okay, everything happens for a reason, and God's working in my life. So I went with this person, you know. And it worked for 2 years. It was great. She took me through the steps. And then it didn't work out anymore for me. She didn't have what I wanted after a while. And then I found my second sponsor. And my second sponsor, man, she's great. She's my sponsor again today, and we work together as friends in that capacity. But, man, I couldn't get away with anything with her. I mean, she was hard. I mean, I used to be the greatest flake. I mean, you know how it is when you get a commitment and, like, somebody says you want to go out Friday night, and then someone else says you want to go out Friday night, and that looks better than the first time, and you, so you go to the second one. She would not let that fly. She was like, you get a calendar, and you write it down, and if someone else asks you something afterwards, you don't change it. You make a commitment. She taught me what commitment meant. It means when I say I'm going to be at her house at 5 o'clock, I'm there at 5 o'clock, or I call. I never did that kind of stuff. You know, I just, oh, sorry, I'm late. You know, I didn't care how it impacted somebody else's life, you know, that they had a family to feed or whatever. Didn't matter to me. I was late. Sorry. Just, I tried, you know. And I was trying to get away with that stuff. It's 2 years sober. 2 years sober, still getting away with that stuff. So she nailed me for that, and I've passed that on to my sponsees, too. I'm big time. They don't get away with any of that. I'm here for 10 minutes, and then I'm gone because I got things I got to do. So if you want help, great, call me or be here. But otherwise, there's lots of people out there. and when it came time to do step four, I was really, really ready because I had been sober for a while, and what happens when I got sober was I started all the stuff that I pushed down, all the feelings and the fears and the inadequacies, insecurities started coming up. And they were like all these like movie pictures were going around, all these like, oh, I did this wrong to this person. And the little picture would flash in my mind, just all the stuff that I did to other people started coming up. And I'm like, I was really uncomfortable, and I was in a lot of pain. And for me, I thought a lot of this stuff was that because I wasn't a good person and that I'd made foolish choices and I had hurt a lot of people. And I had the ego in reverse, like I was the worst of the worst. I didn't come in here with a big old head thinking I was great and everything. I came in here with my head dragging on the floor, you know, and had to learn how to stand up straight and hold it up. And not be the worst of the worst and learn how to be one among many, a worker among workers, just one of you, you know, no big deal. I don't want to be a superstar. I wanted to at one time, don't want that anymore. and when I was writing out my fourth step, I was just trying to think, okay, Diana, for once in your life, let's be honest. Let's see what that's like. Let's tell someone everything. Because I told a little here, a little there, a little here, a little there, kept a little for myself. I had my secrets. And It was really a lot, as you know, if you've done your fourth step, it was really a lot to put it all down in one place, all those things, and then to tell someone about them. For me, step five, it was hard. I was sweating. I mean, I was scared. I don't know what I thought was going to happen, but I was just scared to do it. And I took a long time, and she said, you know, this isn't your last fourth step. If you have something else and you forget about it, it's okay. You're not doing it wrong. But I got to make sure I do it right because I don't want to get drunk. She's like, no, it's okay. If, you know, just take this amount of time, and then let's talk about it. And so I go to her house, and I'm all nervous and everything to read the fifth step, and she's doing her laundry and cleaning up her bedroom while we're doing it. I mean, I'm thinking about this in hindsight now. She's like, okay, yeah, your next thing? Oh, yeah, I did that, and this is what happened to me, blah, blah, blah. And she's, like, topping my stories. And I was really mad at her for doing that because I was like, this is serious. This is things that happened to me. You know, this is very important. And that was good for me, for her to take it lightly and to not be so serious about it. I know it meant a lot to her, and the things that I shared were important to her. That was how I viewed it at the time. And I've got to say that after I did that, I went in her living room and did what the book says, and I thought about it for 1 hour. You know, it just says take 1 hour. It doesn't say take all day and think about what you just did and, you know, take a week before you do the next step. So I did. I took 1 hour, and then we moved on into the steps. And I did not understand step six and step seven for years. I just didn't understand them. I wasn't my way of life to look at myself and say, what was my part in this? Where have I gone wrong? Am I being morally, you know, correct about this? Or is there a selfish motive in this? That's not the way I operate at all before that. And that had to become a habit for me. And it still is not always right up something that I do right away. I don't always like to admit that I'm wrong. As a matter of fact, I remember practicing saying, I'm wrong. I'm sorry, I was wrong. I'd said it out loud. I'm wrong. I'm sorry, I was wrong. Because I don't remember ever saying that, you know? And I just wanted to get comfortable with saying that. So as I moved along in the steps and in sobriety, I struggled, I'd say, my first 6 years in sobriety, constantly working on the steps, constantly looking at myself, going through all the things that you do when you first get sober, your first dance. You know, I got sued in sobriety. I'd never been sued before. Moving out of my parents again after, oh, I finished college, by the way. I went back and I finished college. Never got a job in that degree, but that doesn't matter. I got it. And, you know, the things that come up around work, trying to find a job, and relationships, my girlfriends, forget boyfriends. Okay, I had a couple boyfriends in early sobriety, and that was it. Went for a real long dry spell there afterwards. But I went back into therapy. I had a lot of problems around sex and sexuality, and very confused and very frightened. I had gone through another rape before I got sober of someone I didn't know. So that was two of those I had to go through. And I was getting to the point where I was really afraid at night that someone was coming after me. I would wake up and I'd be really frightened that someone was after me. And I remember going down in my car in the parking lot and I was shaking. I was like this, trying to get my key in the car because I could feel the hairs on my neck. That person was right there. And I just felt like someone was going to do something really violent to me. And those were just part of my demons. And I went back into therapy and we worked through a lot of that stuff and found out reasons for that fear, which was really good. And what I did was I started using the steps to go and illuminate the pockets inside of me that were dark and scary. And once I knew who I was, like, just go and put a little flashlight in that pocket that you know you don't want to go and look at. You know it's scary. And what I did is if it was too scary to do with my sponsor or myself, is I got professional help. And I had someone objectively walk me through that area. So I know who I am today because I've gone there and I went through it. And I've looked at it myself. I don't like everything about me, but you know what? I love me today. I love me today very much. And I am a little child of God, as are all of you. And I remember when Pablo Gomez Jr. said, "Your God doesn't make junk," and that everybody's a child of God. I was like, that brought tears to my eyes. What? I'm not a piece of junk? You got to be kidding me. You know that, and so none of us are? That just brought tears to my eyes. No one had ever really struck me in that way. In sobriety, I struggled for 6 years, as I said, constantly working on stuff. And then I said, you know what? I'm tired of struggling. God, I give my struggle up to you. And I gave it to God. And my life got a little lighter after that. You know, I just kind of started trying to laugh more, go see funny movies, you know, instead of being immersed in all this self-analysis all the time and trying to figure things out and trying to do things perfect. At 5 years sober, I moved up to San Francisco. My brother, all his roommates had moved out, and my roommate and I were splitting. She was going back to school. It was amicable. It was great. I had a successful roommate situation with a girl, and we're still friends today. Excuse me, a woman, and we're still best friends today. So it was our first, for both of us, it was our first successful roommate situation with a woman, with another woman. And my brother said, well, why don't you move up here with me? And I'm thinking, well, hi, baby. And I was thinking, well, I have no reason why not to, you know, I'll just go do it. So I moved up to San Francisco. It was really hard to leave my home group, Saturday Night Live. I used to come down a lot. I still come down infrequently, but it was hard to get connected to another fellowship and another way that they do things up there. But I have, and I created the same thing up there as I had down here, as I dove right into AA up there and I got involved in service and blah, blah, blah. I met a lot of people. Got another sponsor up there for a while. What I have applied the steps to, you know, I made my amends. Most of my amends had been about myself. Not a lot of my amends were out there. Obviously, I had started saying earlier, I healed my primary relationships first, my mom, my dad, my brother, my sister, my grandparents. And this is just for myself. I found that when I found some way to heal those, it doesn't mean that I forgive them everything or that they totally love me and talk to me all the time. It means I found a place in my heart where either I have acceptance of them or acceptance of the situation, or I have a great relationship with them. I have some peace in my heart. And I had to heal those. I felt like, well, if I can't heal with my mom and my dad, how am I going to have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, you know? If I can't have a successful relationship with my dad and my brother, how am I going to have another man in my life? Because I found out by doing an inventory of men and sex, I listed all my relationships from the first grade all the way through. And what was, you know, my motive and what happened in that relationship? What attracted me to that person? How did it end? And, ooh, boy, you want to find patterns about why you do things? That is a great inventory to do. And it didn't mean I stopped just because I figured it out and I saw it, because I continued those patterns and I kept picking those same guys. As a matter of fact, the guy that I dated right before I met my husband was the same MO. And I had gone, I did a third step after that, before that inventory, I did a third step and I said, men and sex, back to you. I'm not touching it until you make it really obvious who the guy is I'm supposed to, you know, at least date or whatever. No dating for like 4 years. No one asked me. And I'm like sitting on my hands, going crazy. And the first guy that I pick is the same pattern. And I was just like, I was devastated. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I did all this work and I really didn't do any work. And the next person I met, I needed to hit that bottom with men and sex to do it one more time, the same darn thing one more time, and to not trust God and to not talk to God about it. One more time. And then I was just like, oh man, I'd rather be without. And I never thought I'd get to that place, because I thought if you didn't have sex, you'd die. I thought I'd rather be without than have this pain in my heart, you know, and in my soul. And when I met my husband, poor guy, when I met my husband, he, you know, I put all the stuff that all these guys did on him, like, oh yeah, I've heard that before. And he's like, I'm not like those other guys. And I said, yeah, I've heard that before too. And it's like, no matter what he said, it didn't fly by me. I said, you know, the only thing that's going to work is if you really care about me, is that you give me the time. And time will tell if our relationship is meant to be. And I checked in with God all the time, and I checked in with my sponsor all the time about each step that I took. And I have a successful relationship with my husband. And we have fun. You know, we have fun. We stay out of each other's program. I try to stay out of his. I jump in there. But he stays out of mine real well. and I'm really fortunate. And I'm really happy. I'm really happy. And we'll be married 6 years in August already. And that's one area where I use the steps. Another area was work. I kept getting these jobs where I'd work my bedinks off, you know. And I gave 125% and I'd get paid $10 an hour. And, you know, I'd go up and I didn't even get paid $10 an hour at this place. I was getting sexually harassed by the men, and then I was the only woman in the office. It was a gas and welding company, shall remain nameless. And not only that, I went up to them. I was getting like $750. I did their accounts receivable, and I got them all this thousands and thousands of dollars back. And I go, and I'm running the office. I'm managing it. I've organized it and everything, right? And I go up to them. I'd like to get $10 an hour, and the guy wouldn't give me $10 an hour, you know. And it's like, I look at it back at it now. I'm like, what a rube. Is that the right word? Oh, man. And then I just kept getting these jobs where I was, like, unappreciated, you know. And I was doing a good job. And I would get these bosses that were, like, jerks to me, you know. And I didn't have a voice. I couldn't stand up and say, you know, you're a jerk. I wish I could have said that, but I never could. I was like, oh. And then I'd go home and what did they say to me? Well, how could they say it? You know, I'd take it home with me. And I'd figure it all out in my head at night, you know, but I couldn't do it when I was there. And, you know, I worked the steps around that. I did an inventory of all the jobs. How did I get the jobs? What happened to the job? What attracted me? And how did it end? And I found patterns in there. And that's the whole thing for the fourth step for me, is these patterns come out of it. And then I could do something different. If I know what my pattern is, at least I'm aware of it, you know, what I'm walking into. And I did this last time was my husband and I wanted to start a family 4 years ago. And we started trying to start a family 4 years ago. And it wasn't working out. And we were trying all these things. And we went and got some extra help. And it still wasn't happening. And, you know, there was, Cece always says in here, God knows what your heart's desire is. And I thought, God, if you know what my heart's desire is, then either fulfill it or remove it. And I would make that prayer. And all I kept getting back was that I had to let go of the outcome. Oh, gosh, that means that maybe I'm not meant to have kids. And that was a hard one. You know, that's like maybe I wasn't meant to be married. I thought maybe I'm not meant to have a significant other. That was hard to let go of. And then not having kids, I was like, okay, maybe I'm of maximum use without kids. I don't know how your plan is, but so far it's been great, and you're right. But I have a hard time letting go of that. And, you know, and then there's always other options. You can always adopt, da-da-da. You know, there's other things to do. But I wasn't, I had to keep letting the attachment of having my own, let that go. It might not be your own. It might be an adoption. And we just kept coming up to all these hurdles, you know, where we just had to let go of the results because we just had no control over this, none. And then when we got pregnant, it was still, I was still like, you know, I'm going to let go of the outcome. Okay, because, you know, things happen. You know, it's not a perfect world and things happen. And I didn't want to set myself up to be devastated. I've done that so many times in so many ways. And I just kept letting go. And some people in my life can understand this. And some people are like, what, are you crazy? Everything's going to be okay. Or you know, they haven't lived my life, obviously. You know, I mean, I've had trials and tribulations in my life. Everything isn't always okay. And it's okay to be prepared for reality. Not to dwell in the horror, but, you know, it's okay to be prepared for reality. What if it doesn't work out? And we got pregnant. I came here to pick up my chip, and I was pregnant. My last birthday I came here. I come back every year and pick up my chip here because I'm 15, and just because I'm not around, it's not because I'm out drinking, okay? It's because I moved away, and I need to come back and tell you that I'm still sober. You know, there's a few people here that know me, and I'm not out drinking, and I don't have better things to do than AA. I'm still in AA, and I still go to AA, and I'm still sober, and I still sponsor people. And that's important to me because I heard that. Everybody doesn't go out after 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, whatever. They don't all go out. They go on with their lives. And when this pregnancy happened, it was really interesting. I was so happy. I was so happy to be pregnant. I didn't care if I had morning sickness. I was like, bring it on. You know, it beats the alternative, having nothing, you know. And the delivery went, you know, it was hard. But, you know, is it hard? Is it hard to go through something that you want really bad? You know, is it hard? If you want to stay sober, is it that hard to do something a little different? Is it hard to feel a little bit of pain that's going to hurt really bad in the beginning? But you know what? There's a beginning and a middle and an end to everything, even your pain. You know, life's going to pass me by and I'm going to be wah, wah, wah me. You know, oh, I had this hard time. You know, well, that's over and it's been over for a long time. And to get on with my life. I was taught here by the people that had a lot of sobriety that you could do anything you want to do in sobriety. You could have anything that you want to have in sobriety. And that's where I come around to that letting go of the results, because maybe what I learn in seeking out something with God is that it's really not the best thing for me. And I kind of learned that in that process. But the gifts that God has given me are just incredible. And my relationship with God is incredible. It's very familiar. It's not really formal. What I try to tell my sponsees is invite God into your situation. You know, if you're having a hard time with your husband or you're having a struggle at work, you know, take a moment, invite him in. Please be with me. Help me say the right thing. Don't use my, you know, I tell myself, don't use your words, Diana. You know, let God speak through you. You don't know anything, you know. And to just, like, try to be in the moment and speak through my heart, not my head, you know, not my anger or my resentment or my fear, but to speak through my heart and to act through my heart. And, you know, it doesn't happen all the time, but that's my prayer, and that's how I try to live my life. And it's hard. I mean, coming here tonight and having a child and you know, trying to be prepared and driving here. I wasn't used to driving the traffic. I was stressed out, man. You know, I was like really stressed out. And I started going, what if, you know, what if what? What? Your guys are going to die if I don't make it here? I don't think so. You're going to get someone else to come up here and speak and you're going to have a great night, you know? And if I can just trust that God is working in my life, that things are going to work out okay. And I practice that. You know, I say, okay, it's just going to be whatever it's going to be, and I have no control over this. There are things I have control over, and I take action in those areas, but some things I don't. And I let go. It's amazing. You know, like Christmas shopping. I don't have time. I got to bake cookies. I got to shop. I got to wrap my gifts. I got to go here. I got to go there. And at Christmas, I just go, okay, whatever's going to be, whatever I have time for, it's going to be all right. And all of a sudden, my world opens up and I have time to do what I need to do, you know, and the things that aren't important fall away and it doesn't bother me. You know, it's just magic like that. I think that God is here in Alcoholics Anonymous as he is out there. I mean, I don't think we have any special pipeline to God. I think that because we're alcoholic, that we can find God here through Alcoholics Anonymous if we have the kind of problem being an alcoholic like our book describes. We can find God here through this process, okay? And I think other people, and I've seen it, can find God in other ways. God is just so big for me and so infinite that He created me, so He's got more knowledge than I do. I don't know anything about Him or what His plan is or how He works, so I just give Him the credit. You know, I just give Him the benefit of the doubt. Like, what if they're right about God? You know, great. You know, what if they're wrong? Then I've lived a good life. I've lived a life that I can lay my head down and it's quiet. And you know what? My heart is full. And when I used to lay down, when I was drinking, I was so lonely. I would cry myself to sleep. I would just crawl up in the fetal position and cry. And that was sober and that was drunk, crying because I was so empty inside. Even sober, many, many times, just saying, I don't understand. I don't understand. I feel so lonely. I'm so lonely. And then I would just invite God into my life and say, fill my heart and let me know You're there. And I would get some relief. And that's the magic to me today. That's the parting of the Red Seas. That's the burning bush. You know, for me, it's keep coming back to meetings if you're struggling or if you're working on something and it's just taking a long time. Oh, well, you know, I mean, just don't give up before the miracle happens. And that's another cliche in here. Don't give up 5 minutes before the miracle happens. And I've never wanted to drink because why would I want to take that chance that I don't have another recovery? Recovery has just been too awesome to take the chance to drink. Nothing's been that bad to drink over yet. And, you know, the farther I get away from a drink, and coming here and speaking reminds me and keeps it fresh for me, and sponsoring people keeps it fresh for me. So I haven't forgotten what it's like to have my life when I was 24. I just turned 40. And I love my life. I'm totally excited about being 40, you know? And it's taken off, and I'm going to do all these new things. And it's just going to go on and on and on. And I'm not going to go on and on and on. It's 9:15, and I'm really grateful that God put Alcoholics Anonymous into the human realm. It gives my little spirit something to try to work for. You know, I'm just a human being on the planet with a spirit inside of me that I try to feed. And the more I feed it, the stronger it gets. And it is helpful to have you in my life to help me. You know, I don't do this alone. It's me and God and you. And likewise, you know, if you're new or if you've been here a while and you're struggling, talk to us because we can't read your mind. Tell us if you're hurting or tell us if you need some extra help, you know. It's something that we all do together. So thank you for hanging with me tonight.
Great job.